Wow, there's more. They've grown. Yeah.
Yo so Bhagavan Arahant Sama Sambuddho Suvakato Yena Bhagavata Dhammo Supatipanno Yassa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Tamayang Bhagavantang Sadhamang Sasangang Ime Hisakare Hiyatavahang Avopite Hiyapipujayama Sadhuno Bhante Bhagava Suchira Parinibhutopi Pachima Janata Nukampamanasa Ime Sakare Dugata Panakala Bhute Patikanhatu Amhakak Dikharatak Hitaya Sukaya Alahang Sammasambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Sama Sambuddho Vichacharana Sampanno Sugato Lokavidu Anuttaro Purissa Dhamma Sarati Sata Deva Manu Sanang Buddha Bhagava Tamahang Bhagavantang Abhipujayami Tamahang Bhagavantang Sirasanamami Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sanditiko Akariko Ehipasiko Opanayiko Pachatang Veditapo Vinyuhi Tamahang Dhammang Abhipujayami Tamahang Dhammang Sirasanamami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Iyaya patipano bhagavato savaka sango samichi patipano bhagavato savaka sango Iyati dancha tari purisa yugani Atta purisa pugala Esa bhagavato savaka sango Ahuneyo pahuneyo dakineyo Anjali karaniyo anutarak punyaketang lokasa tamahang sangak apipujayami tamahang sangak sirasanamami.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again.
Great, no questions this evening. We can go now. Oh, no. We found the questions. You ever notice, no matter how much time you give to answering questions, there's always another one. Okay, here we go. The first question. To any of the bhikkhunis, ha ha ha, it's one of yours. That's what it says here, to any of the bhikkhunis. Okay, I'll give that to you later. Diraja, how to overcome the mind wandering off during sleeping? It takes a long time to calm my mind down in next morning meditation. You don't control sleep. All you can do is maybe program the mindfulness. I will have a nice, peaceful sleep. That's sometimes what you do loving kindness to yourself and to the whole world. When you feel peaceful and calm, then it's very easy to go to sleep and you have a nice deep sleep. So that's this one person when I gave some sessions once in ABCAP. ABCAP, the Australian Association of Buddhist Counselors and Psychotherapists. I know there's one monk who lives over in Sydney, calls it Madcap. He says that, not me, in case anyone's listening. And anyway, that one of the presenters there was just chatting over a cup of coffee or something, and she was saying that when people can't go, I think I mentioned this earlier, when they can't go to sleep at night, she tells them that just a gentle scanning of the body, you know, from the toes and just relaxing your toes. I'm not going to do this now because it works so well, you go to sleep and then no one will be listening. So, but you do the scan up slowly, relaxing everything, feeling it, giving a lot of kindness until your toes are the most relaxed you've ever felt your toes in the whole life. You're in bed and then the feet even go like the soles of the feet, the uppers of the feet, and don't say that we don't believe in a soul in Buddhism. That's not the spelling I meant. And then the heels, and then the ankles. And they just go up slowly and just relax it. And after a while, you really enjoy it because you're relaxing the whole of your body and you feel what it's like. To have the body just, you've had a busy day, even just walking back to your hut or something, and alas, you're laying back there nice and comfortable, everything is nice and settled. You've got nothing to do for a few hours until you wake up in the morning. And especially here, because it doesn't matter if you don't make it to the tomorrow's chanting. Well, I must say that tomorrow's chanting is special. Tomorrow's chance is the last chance. So anyway, but you don't have to get up in time. But then what happens? You just relax everything. You've got nothing to do, no past, no future. You're not trying to get to sleep. You're just relaxing your body. And she told me, and I think it's, if you do it properly, I can't see why this doesn't work, that even before you get to your chest, you're fast asleep. Simply because you're relaxing the body, you're focusing on something which doesn't include thinking. It's just very gentle, feeling the body, relaxing it to the max. And after a while, you're fast asleep. If that doesn't work, you can always get a recording, because I do many of the recordings, and get the recording of, you know, like many people do, they listen to, when you were a kid, sometimes your mummy or your daddy would read you a story when you were going to bed. So you can think of one of Ajahn Brahm's stories, like the coffin story. It's a good excuse to do this one. So you record this and you play it to yourself at night time when you're in bed, nice and comfortable. Nice Ajahn Brahm telling a story so you can have a nice sleep. And the coffin story is this. This meditator went to the temple, and after the talk was finished, the quickest way back to their house was actually taking the shortcut through the cemetery. Ooh, yeah, the cemetery. And it was a shortcut. Didn't believe in ghosts, so it doesn't matter. So I took the shortcut through the cemetery. And in the cemetery, they don't have much lights on, as on the street. And so hardly anyone goes down there at night time. That's only just no superstition. So she was walking through the cemetery. She got about halfway. No problems at all. Nothing. So carried on walking. And when she just got past the halfway mark, that is when she started to hear something strange. Have you ever had the feeling that something or somebody is following you? Ooh. So she felt that something was following her. So automatically she started walking a bit faster. And as she was walking faster, she was sure whatever it was following her was also walking faster. But it wasn't walking. What she heard was like that, but only with a bump. Bump. And she didn't know what it was, so she just walked really fast. She's almost near the edge of the cemetery gates. And then she heard it really clearly, bump, bump, bump. And she made one of the big mistakes. She decided to turn around and look, find out what it was. And right there and then she almost had a heart attack, because what she saw was a coffin. Vertical. Bump, bump, bump. Coming after her. Now, you could leave right now if you wish, but when you go out, remember there's nothing out there. Bump, bump, bump. It's quite a long way to your cottage. Bump. Bump, bump, bump. And it's a vertical coffin. And you could see the cobwebs on it and the dirt just falling off it. But as it was coming after her. And that was it. So she really freaked out. She ran as fast as she could. Out of the cemetery gate, thinking maybe the coffin's not allowed outside. But no, that coffin came right outside the gate. And was bumping, bumping down the road after her. And fortunately, her house was very close by. So she actually didn't open the garden gate, you know, the gate to get into the garden. She jumped over that and got to the front of her house, got out the keys from her pocket, and she dropped them on the ground. Oh, my goodness. And as she dropped them on the ground, she saw the coffin had reached the garden gate. Bump, 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 bump. And she thought, maybe the coffin can't jump. Coffins can't jump. They go bang into the garden gate. Bang! And that poor garden gate just couldn't stand it. You could see the hinges where they were breaking. Bump! So, oh my God. She picks up any old key would do, put it in the lock. She was very lucky. It was the correct key. And as she turned the lock, she could hear, bump! As a coffin broke the garden gate, bump, 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 coming down the short path after her. Fortunately, she opened the door, jumped inside, closed the door, and locked it, everything. And you could see the coffin on the outside, you know, through the window in the door, in the entrance doors. She'd made it. She got home. She was safe. Bump! Went the coffin against the front door. Bump! Even louder. And that front door, that's supposed to be the most secure door in the whole house. Bump! And it was giving way. Bump! The wood was splintering. Bump! The hinges were coming off. Bump! The screws were coming out. So she ran upstairs. The only other room in the house which had a lock was the toilet. So she was standing on the top of the stairs when there was a huge...
Bump!
Yes. Only louder. It went right through the front door. And there was no escape now, she thought. But she was just watching down there in total fear. And then he saw the coffin. You know, he's got into the house now. He looked to the left, couldn't see her. Looked to the right, couldn't see her. Looked up. Bump, 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 bump. As it started to come up the stairs. And so she ran into the bathroom, locked the door, and had nowhere else to run to. Bump! Against the bathroom door, louder bump! She knew she was done for. Because that door could break down, so that coffin could break down the front door. The bathroom door was nothing compared to that. Bump! The coffin came in, broke down the door, and she was just facing it. She didn't know what to do. And sometimes it's really great when you don't know what to do, because then you innovate. She just reached for something on the shelf to throw at that coffin. It was some medicine for something or other. So she threw it against the coffin. And the bottle broke, and all this brown liquid fell over the coffin. And the coffin stopped. Never moved again. It was cough mix. Stops the coffin. Okay. You can groan as much as you like. But that's like the stories that people tell at night to calm down the kids when they can't go to sleep. Sorry about that. Couldn't resist. Our Buddhist and other contemplative Indian traditions, e.g. Tantra, Vedanta, Yoga, compatible. Are Moksha and Nibbana the same thing, experienced but explained conceptually different? If not, how can very similar practices produce such different forms of enlightenment? I think I mentioned this already. Just before the Buddha passed away, someone came and asked him, can you get enlightened in any other tradition? And he would say, yeah, of course. As long as you practice the Eightfold Path, then you'd be enlightened. So it's not what you call yourself, it's what you practice. And that practice, with the right view and good teachings and meditation, then it works. Very lovely answer. It's not names, it's the practices. Please tell the Nimitta story about the animals coming down to the still lake. Sometimes this retreat doesn't have to be tonight. Okay, I'll tell it tomorrow night.
Yeah, what? Yesterday.
Oh, did you do this yesterday?
Yeah.
Right.
I think there was some left over from last night.
Okay, so you answered this already?
No.
Oh. Okay. Nimitta story. I think I mentioned this before to you, but it's a very nice simile, Ajahn Chah's simile. This is the real simile of the still forest pool. I remember him telling me this. He said, a still forest pool simile, that sometimes when you are going into the jungles just for some solitude and you're walking, you have to find some water, a lake, a pond, or a little river. You can't find things like wells or some taps, because this is the jungles, it's away from people. So you find a nice little lake or something, or river, and then you wash, because you know, you always really feel really dirty after a day's walking. You strain some water, you know, to drink, and you maybe wash a robe or something, and then you set up your mosquito net umbrella, not right by the edge of the water, maybe about 10 or 15 meters away from the edge, because the animals would come in the evening. And he said, Ajahn Chah just told me that sometimes he'd sit there, he'd, you know, do his little washing and stuff, and set up his mosquito net umbrella and sit there quietly, sometimes with his eyes open. It's amazing, even though there may be just starlight, you still, you know, can see amazingly when your eyes are used to the darkness. And especially if there's a moon up, then of course it's gorgeous, you can see so clearly. And he said he'd wait there sometimes, it was a clear night. And of course then the jungle animals would come out to drink by the still forest pool. The ordinary animals, you know, the tigers and the bears and stuff. And remember that the most dangerous animal in the forest, in the jungle, is us, human beings. Human beings have killed more animals, more tigers, than tigers have killed humans. And so when they come out, they would be very sensitive. First of all, the leader of the pack, whoever it was, would come out and sniff. Remember, they couldn't see very well, so they'd sniff and they'd listen. And if they could hear the sound of a human being, they would run away. Even if they were tired, even they were thirsty and really needed a drink, they wouldn't risk it. Because, you know, after they come out, just their young would come out as well, the cubs. And they would go and play by the still forest pool. Only if they thought there was no one there to watch them. So Ajahn Chah said he had to be perfectly still. Not even saying, oh, yeah, or be afraid. All those upakalesas in the Upakalesa Sutta applied. And if he was very still and calm, then the animals wouldn't know he was there. They come out to play. He said, it was great fun. This, you know, this was before Nature Channel, National Geographic or whatever. So, you know, to see it live by yourself, you know, 50, 60 years ago was amazing. And then, he said, after the ordinary animals came out and played and messed around in the lake, then the very rare animals would come out. Animals which very few people see. So beautiful, but so sensitive. And those beautiful, rare animals would come out and play by the still forest pool, but he had to be very still then. And he said that his teachers and his parents had never told him such gorgeous animals existed. And that was referring to nimittas in a simile. He'd be really still, not excited. And the still forest pool always refers to your mind. They come out to play by your mind. And they're great fun. Even like somebody today was asking about a nimitta sometimes. And this is a nice thing to describe and the solution. Sometimes a nimitta comes up, it doesn't center, it's over here somewhere. Or up above or something. It's not centered. And a nice way of looking at that, it's like the nimitta is testing you out. Are you still enough for me? Because if you go looking for it, moving your attention, doing something, it all gets disturbed and you lose that nimitta. You just got to stay where you are, don't do anything, be absolutely still. Just like you have to be absolutely still when these animals come out to play by the still forest pool. If you are absolutely still, that nimitta, no matter where it starts from, will center itself. Right in front of you. You don't move. Don't do anything. Let the nimitta come to you. And that's how it works. And if the nimitta isn't beautiful enough, maybe the first nimittas come out, they're just the ordinary animals. But then the special ones come out afterwards. You have to be very still for those. When they do come out, they're gorgeous, like you've never seen before. That's the simile of the still forest pool. Can a lay person be enlightened? Has any lay person been fully enlightened? Thank you. Some years ago, there was some teacher over in, it was in Sri Lanka at the time, and there was one of the disciples, one of the strong supporters here in Perth. His daughter was, I think, finished year 12, or no, maybe finished university, no, year 12, I think. And so let's go and do a little retreat with this monk. And this monk sort of told her she was fully enlightened. She was a lay person. She had very nice, good samadhi many years ago. But then what happened, that because this lay this teacher at the time told her she was enlightened, that what to do next? So as I mentioned to you, the story is, if you don't ordain very quickly, then you die. And so she decided she'd better ordain. So they ordained her. And I think it was a 10-precept nun, but she wore the robes. And then she came over to even to stay a little while at Bodhinyana Monastery. I wasn't the boss then. And other people just, you know, tried to teach her and about what to do next. I don't know what advice they gave her, but soon she realized she wasn't enlightened. And she eventually got married. After she disrobed. I was very disappointed with that. It ruined about a year or 2 years of that woman's life. And it turned her away from Buddhism for a while. Because when people say these things, whatever you say does have consequences. So you have to be very careful. So she wasn't fully enlightened. But anyway, just to become a stream winner is an incredible thing. I know people can get stream winning. Lay people can get jhanas and stream women and once returning and non-returning, like Chitta, the person I mentioned today. There's many people who became enlightened then as a non-returner. But you can know who's a non-returner as a lay person, because there's so many things which... there was this one fellow who was... this is the Gatikara, the potter story. And Gatikara, he was a non-returner. And the only reason why he didn't ordain, because his two parents were blind and he had to look after them. But it was really inspiring just how he looked after his parents, a lay person. But what he would do, he was a potter. So if he dug the earth, he's going to kill many animals. So instead he just waited until the farmers had finished putting the dikes and the paddy fields together and asked him any clay left over if he could take to make a few pots. Or any animals would dig into the clay and he would take some of the soil which the animals dug up. He was just that careful not to harm any living beings. And when he made those pots, he would never sell them. He just put a sign outside of his kiln. Anyone wants a pot, please take one for free. But if you want to leave any rice or beans, please leave rice or beans for me. And that's how he lived. He didn't have any money. But, you know, because he didn't need very much, that's how he got enough to support his old mother and father. When I saw just how, like a non-returner, someone who's achieved some understanding of the Dhamma, you pretty much tell pretty easily. Just, you know, they're such a simple living person. They're not concerned with things. So, they can be, but the other thing I was saying, that why? What's wrong with ordaining? Because sometimes, I often say, similarly, so you understand this, can you walk to Sydney from here? Forget about COVID and stuff, but that just complicates things. But can you physically walk from here to Sydney? Of course you would. You don't have to go by plane or by bus. But crikey, there are planes, there are buses. If you want to go to Sydney, get on a plane or a bus, for goodness sake. It's much more comfortable. That's what we've got planes and buses for. It's the same with like being monks or nuns, or even just being novice monks, novice nuns, or even just joining the Sangha and just being an Anagarika there. That is possible. And the reason why the Buddha set these things up, because it's a much more convenient path for you. A lot of people who do really get into the practice say it's very disturbing living at home. It's very disturbing living life. Because sometimes, just that story I told you about going to the Centrelink, can you prove who you are? And I couldn't. Because you just don't fit in. Anyway, Is there one like Buddha effigy or statues as appear different? What age is the statue depicting? And also looks kind of female as well as male in different depictions. Excellent. Because the idea of the statue is not to be a lifelike representation of the Buddha. For example, you can see the little thing coming out the top of his head. Do you think that was real? That's what he really had? If it was, then people would sooner or later find out who he was. So, as I mentioned, one story, there's other stories as well, that when King Ajatasattu first went to see the Buddha, he was staying in the Bamboo Grove Monastery, and he had to ask his the guide there was the Dr. Ajivaka, Dr. Jivaka, saying, which one of these monks here is the Buddha? And he said it was the one sitting against the pillar facing east. So he did not look much different than any other monk at that time. So, what age is depicting is supposed to be ageless, not old, not young. What is the, is it female or male? That's a beautiful thing I was very inspired with. If you look at the most effective, inspiring figures of the Buddha, you can't give it a gender, because the Buddha is supposed to be genderless. This, you go past that distinction between the male and the female, or in between. You're nothing, you're just a symbol of what's possible. So it's good you saw it looking a little bit female. It's not male, it's not female, it's neither. It's supposed to be nicely in peace, and the symbolism, the representation of it, is really important. Is there any significance or meaning to different hand positions that are depicted in statues or images as printed on literature? Yes, of course. You can see we haven't got one here. They're usually on a standing position. They've got their hands in front like this. And that's actually for playing soccer when there's a free kick happening. If you know your soccer, you've seen that many, many times. And this over here is being a policeman. In other words, no, there's no real meaning there. Sometimes they say this is having the earth bear witness that when the Buddha was enlightened, that he deserved to sit on that seat, whatever. But many of these things, they're not so important, but you can give them importance and make it very beautiful. And I say that for making a Buddha statue is very difficult. And some of the artists really get it totally right. And you can not see that by the hand mudra, but just by the figure on the face and just this depiction. And sometimes it's just so peaceful and beautiful. And you see, I've seen obviously thousands of Buddha statues in my life. And it's the one outside of Benares in Sarnath, in the museum there, which always, as I said, gets me, makes me cry. I see it, you know, for me it's the most beautiful Buddha statue in the world. When you see an object of beauty like that, it inspires you. You're not just crying out of sadness, you're crying, wow, this is amazing. I don't know why it affects me like that, but it does every time. So it's not the hand positions are not as important as the beauty, the peace, the kindness on the face. Dear Raja, mind is like a monkey in the forest going everywhere. Please explain something too. Okay. Monkey, you know sometimes that monkeys just get so maligned. You say you've got a monkey mind. How do you know? Have you ever been a monkey before? That is defamation of monkeys. So in this particular story, there was a monkey. He went to the temple one day because it was a big day, Waisak day. And when there's lots of people at the temple, someone always drops something. They leave something on a plate, just like the parrots and the other birds who come to Bodhinyana Monastery at lunchtime. They get a good feed down there for sure. And so the monkey saw that somebody dropped a mango or something and sort of picked it up, but also, you know, was hearing the priest there. You know, this was in Sri Lanka. And the priest was giving a sermon about meditation. And what really made it interesting for the monkey, he heard this term, monkey mind, monkey mind. So, wow, the priest is actually talking about us. I never realized that those Buddhist monks knew all about monkeys. So the monkey listened. But what he heard, it really upset him. Because the priest, the monk, was saying that a monkey mind is a bad mind. You've got to stop the monkey mind. You know, it drives you crazy and stops you being peaceful. Monkey minds are bad. And that really upset the monkey. That's actually defamation. That is, you can't sort of speak like that these days. And so he swung back into the jungle, went into the place where his fellow monkeys lived, and he complained, said, "You wouldn't believe what I heard. These monks over there, it's libelous, defamation, it's abuse, verbal abuse. You can't do that these days. Well, we need to get a lawyer. We go to the World Wildlife Fund or whoever it is and get a legal case against these monks calling about monkey mind. There's nothing wrong with a monkey mind. I'm a monkey, I've got a monkey mind. Monkey minds are fine." And all the other monks heard that. Sorry, all monkeys heard that. Oops. All the other monkeys in that forest heard that, and they started jumping up and down. "These monks are no good. Monkey mind is okay. We're going to have to do something about this. We can't just sit around and let this happen." But then the head monkey in that little troop of monkeys, he said, "Listen, that's exactly what those monks were talking about. Look at you, jumping up and down. That is what he means by the monkey mind. You jump up and down, you complain, you do all this stuff, but you never get anything done." And the other monkey said, "Oh yeah, that's right. I suppose we'd have to accept we're monkeys, we have monkey minds." But the head monkey said, "Listen, I've also been to that temple and I've been listening. There's a way to overcome the monkey mind. How do you do that?" He said, "Well, you've got to meditate." So all the monkeys said, "Yeah, let's meditate. We want to meditate. Yeah, meditation is good. We're going to meditate." "Shut up and calm down," said the head monkey. He said, "What do we do?" He said, "You've got to get like cushions, like the zafus, first of all." "Yeah, let's get a cushion, the zafu, yeah, we can do that." So they went into the forest and they got some grass and they got some leaves and they got some nice things and they put them all together into the nice thing and they sat on the... "Now what do we do? Now what do we do? Tell us what to do next." And the old monkey said, "Now, you sit on there, left foot over the right foot. Left paw over right paw over the left paw. Straighten your backs and close your eyes." And all the monkeys did that. It was the first time in history, even in Sri Lanka, that monkeys meditated. And they were so quiet for about 30 seconds. And then one monkey put his hand up. Excuse me. "Don't you remember that we planned today, well, all the people over in the temple, we planned today to go over to the banana plantation and steal the bananas, for our lunch?" "Yeah, I was thinking the same," said one of the other monkeys. "So yes, let's go do that first." So they all got off their little zafus and they swung all the way to the banana plantation. No one was there. They stole lots of bananas, but they said, "Look, it's not lunchtime yet. So we won't eat it, we'll just get it ready." So they got all these bananas and put them in a big heap in the middle of the place where they were meditating, went back onto their zafus and started meditating again. It's one less thing they needed to do. And as they were meditating there, they put their right paw of the left paw back straight, heads down quiet, for another 30 seconds. "Excuse me," said another monkey. "I've been thinking, it's not lunchtime yet, I agree with that, but before we eat those mangoes, we have to peel them first. I've just been thinking just how we should peel them and everything. So, but why don't we peel everything first of all? Then I won't have to think about that." And all the other monkeys said, "Yes, that's a very good idea. I was thinking the same. We've got to peel those." So we won't eat them yet. No, it's not lunchtime yet. We'll just peel them. So they appealed all those monkeys and had a nice... peeled bananas. They didn't eat them yet. They went back to their cushions, sat on the cushions, right paw of the left paw back straight. One less thing out of the way. And they sat quietly. Excuse me, said another monkey. I've been thinking. You know how we think. He said, before we eat those bananas, I never said it. Before we eat those bananas, it's true. Before we eat the bananas, we've got to put them in our mouth before we eat them. So let's get that out of the way first of all. We won't eat them yet, won't swallow them. There's one less thing I have to worry about and think about. And they, yeah, good idea, great idea. So they all got a banana each and put them in their mouth. They didn't eat them yet. A couple of monkeys got two bananas in their mouth. One got three. And then they, with bananas in their mouth, they went back on the cushions. And they sat on the cushions, the right paw of the left paw, thumbs slightly touching, back straight, and closed their eyes with the bananas in their mouth. They couldn't speak because they had bananas in their mouth. But once all the monkeys had their eyes closed, they ate all those monkeys, all those... monkeys had to be quiet. They ate all those bananas. And once they'd eaten all those bananas, just one by one they got off their cushions and they swung into the forest, had a snooze or something, I don't know what they did. But that's what happened when monkeys try to meditate. And it gives the real description of a monkey mind. It's not a mind which thinks too much. A mind which thinks, I'll get this out of the way and then I'll meditate. That's a monkey mind. Can we go and get the bananas first of all? No, we go and peel them first of all. We go and put them in the mouth first of all. We won't eat them. That type of mind we call the monkey mind. Dear Ajahn, what should we do if we have rats or cockroach infestation since we're unable to kill them? Oh, I love the rat. What? Oh, you love the rats. If you love the rats, how nice rat. Uh-huh. No, honestly, that sometimes that even recently, there's one of the ladies here. She didn't have infestations. They were outside her house, but there's no way she could stop them coming in. And so I told her to do this, and she said she didn't believe me, but she had a lot of faith in me, been following me for a long time, so she tried it and said it worked. I told her to go do some chanting for those ants outside her house. Do some loving kindness chanting and tell those ants, please. Please leave, because if you don't leave, you know, I will have to do something like spraying and stuff. I don't want to harm you or hurt you. There's plenty of places you can live outside, but please don't live in my house. You know, otherwise it's going to be dangerous for you. She said that with kindness. And she said after a week, the ants had gone. She didn't really believe me, but she wanted to try it out. So that's what happened. So if you have like rats or cockroaches, sometimes we have mice in the kitchens at Bodhinyana Monastery. But you know, there's plenty of Buddhist mouse traps. These are ones which don't kill the mice, but capture them. So then when we got the mouse in the trap, then what do we do with it? We thought about this a long time. We decided the obvious thing to do is we've got to take it away from the monastery. So we take it up Kingsbury Drive to Carnet Prison Farm. We think, well, that mouse has done bad karma from stealing from the mice, so he can go in jail for a while. And that's what he used to do with the mice in Carnet Prison Farm. And for cockroaches, we once had a number of German cockroaches was their name, and infested the kitchen over there. But afterwards, you know, we found out that where they come in was a lot of times was we weren't keeping the kitchen clean enough, and also that on cardboard. So that we asked everybody, please don't bring cardboard into the kitchen. You know, you can sort of leave it outside, and then we can take the fruit or whatever's in there inside the kitchen, but don't bring it inside, because sometimes they hide in little holes in the cardboard. And then it's been pretty okay since that time. Sometimes you get a few mice in there, but we put the traps out there and catch the mice. And then they we take them to Carnet or other mice places. But do you like mice? You can always take some to your place if you want to. Reading Citta Samyutta, is it in the Vinaya rules that a monk shall keep quiet if he does not know the answer to a lay person's question? No, not always. And sometimes you just say, I don't know. If so, is it the duty of the lay people not to repeat the same question if the monk kept quiet the first round? No, not always. Because sometimes you don't know if that monk was just didn't hear it properly. Or sometimes it happens that the senior monk knows the answer but wants somebody else to answer it, just to give that other person confidence. There's all sorts of reasons why you don't answer it, but ask somebody else to answer it for you. Just like in that story of Albert Einstein, just when the chauffeur was pretending to be Albert Einstein, was asked a tough question, and the chauffeur said, that's such an easy question, even my chauffeur in the back can answer that. Remember that story? Yeah. So that could be what happens. If Anapanasati is for the purpose of quelling thoughts, it's for the purpose of getting enlightened. Is it synonymous with the first of the five methods described in the Vitakka Santana Sutta? No. Anapanasati is much bigger than that. When life pulls at us, emotions threaten to overwhelm. What is the bridge from such unwholesome states to become what established in the first of the five methods described in the above-mentioned sutta? No, just life pulls at us. It just lures us in. But it doesn't physically pull us in. Sometimes you can think, what do I want to get involved in that for? You know, I remember when I was a young monk, sometimes I still had lust, and sometimes you think, well, you know, I'm still young. Not anymore. And you know, I remember a few girlfriends which I knew, and I was stopping at Jambam. But then what I did to try and overcome those fantasies, and it worked very well, is actually fast-forward them. Because then, fast forward, then what, then what, then what, then what? And then all the fun was actually in trying to get there. But then what? Oh, then you're married and you ride happily together into the sunset. Yeah, sure. And so when you thought that through further, then what? Then you get old. Then what? And you miss your wonderful chance to develop this deep meditation wisdom and get free from samsara, get reborn again. So I noticed something, that a lot of time what really pulls at people is the promise that the next chili is a sweet one. Doesn't matter how many chilies you've eaten, you know they're just all hot and burning, but you always think the next one, you learn from the last mistake, so the next one will be okay. And after a while I looked at that and said, is it really? And I used, you know, whatever knowledge I had of human nature. How difficult it is to live with yourself. So how difficult do you think it is to live with another person? If you really want to do that, fine, but it takes a lot of skill. You do learn a lot in the end, but then sometimes you just wonder. I remember one of the monks, he went to the US to visit his whatever family were left, and he met one of his old school friends, another one who was in the same class as he was when he was young. And when she saw him, she said, "Oh, great, you've come here. Can I invite you to my wedding?" He said, "I thought you were already married." "Oh, yes, I was. This is, I think, my 9th or 10th. This is in California." "So you've been married 9 or 10 times? He said, "Yeah." "Why do you do that?" And she was honest, and she said something which was really quite interesting. At least she was honest. She said, "Well, look, I love the courting, you know, trying to find somebody to be with. And I love the excitement of it. You know, does he really like me? Do I really like him? And the engagement, oh, that is just so sweet. I love getting engaged." "And then once we get engaged, then we have to plan a marriage and the ceremony there. Oh, that's so exciting, getting nice dresses and planning stuff. And then the wedding ceremony itself is just so amazing. I love all of that. It's just what happens afterwards I don't like." "So after I get married, then we get divorced quickly, and then I start again." You know, sometimes you think, well, maybe she's got something there. Do you reckon? I wouldn't try, it's really expensive. But anyway, so when life pulls at us, sometimes it's distorted perception which actually sees that this is something worthwhile being pulled. You only go with that if you get sucked into the delusion of it. You're going to be happy ever after. And also remember the story of, you know, sometimes some partnerships are really happy. I remember this couple, they really had been sort of such a perfect match, and they'd been married for 40-50 years. But then what happened? They had hardly any unhappiness at all. They loved each other dearly and hardly ever argued. They were just really kind to one another. But then what happened? One of them got sick. Old age. Was dying. And the partner just suffered so much. As much happiness as they had, now it's been taken away from them. And they realized that the happiness they had was temporary. They were in denial to that for years and years and years. Anyway, when I meditate and become peaceful, often my heartbeat is more prominent than my breath. And I find its rhythm and pace is quite disturbing compared to the breath. Any advice? Yeah, that's a good question. It does happen. It's try not to focus on the heart. Because if you focus on the heart, you tend to disturb it. Whatever you look at, usually, you disturb. And so what we try and do is use a little simile which I learnt when I used to go travelling on the back on the aircraft. And on the aircraft, and the right in front of you, you know, on the back of the seat in front of you, you had the video screen. And on that video screen, they always would play the what's it called? The safety. You know, what happens if something goes wrong on the aircraft? I don't know why they play that for, because if something goes wrong, everyone dies anyway. Yeah. Mostly. But anyway. So, that video safety. And when I looked at that, it was a strange thing happened. Because when I started looking, it was only a small screen. And you could see the upholstery around it and the little plastic around the video screen. But then when I was watching the in-flight safety video, that's what it was called, then I found that my vision went right inside and started to small. The upholstery started disappearing as I was focusing in, like zooming in, like on Google Maps. And as I was focusing more, even the plastic rim of that screen disappeared. And my mind just focused in on the screen, the action, and I couldn't see the edge. And I didn't go any smaller, it stopped right there. my mind fat into that tiny screen. And because of that, I've been to some people's houses, and the video cameras, or video screens rather, you have on there are huge. They keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, the LCD, whatever you call it, screens which people have. So sometimes I just wonder, what do you do that for? You've only got a small little screen. Because you start looking at it and your image, just, vision just goes right inside and just fits perfectly on the size of the screen, or maybe on just on your iPhone. So what do you need the big screens for? I'll tell you why I need the big screens. To impress your visitors. That's all. But anyway, that's with the watching the heartbeat and watching the breath. If you try and just push away the heartbeat, you can't do it. The heartbeat becomes the center of your field of attention. But if you put the breath in the center of your field of attention, whatever's on the outside, like the breath, like the sound, like if it's in an aircraft, some kid screaming, if you put the center on the breath, and the breath, you know how to value it and look at it with a sense of care and joy, then that just takes up the whole screen in your mind. And the feeling of the heartbeat just falls off. You're focusing, you're zooming in. Like zooming in on Google Maps, what's on the edge, what's to the left or right, you can't see. You zoom into the center. That ability of zooming in, by focusing on the center, giving a sense of importance or joy, happiness, then what's on the outside disappears. It is different in different religions have different belief in rebirth. Then what actually happens? Do people believe in different religions, go to different paths, nibbana, whatever, non-rebirth, etc.? No, just that once a person passes away, then they go up to, they get reborn. If they get reborn into heaven, there's a little place where the Buddhists are, and they say, just over there is the Christians. They don't know that we're up here too. No, that's only joking. It doesn't matter what you believe. There are some things, whether you believe it or not, it happens. So you get reborn. Even, it's one of the reasons why that Plato's Republic, the last chapter of that was how Socrates, because Plato was writing about Socrates' teachings, how Socrates believed rebirth happens. He said once a person dies, they go over the river Styx, yeah. And once they reach the destination to the Elysian Fields, and there you rest, relax, don't have to do anything, just get to better, because you may have been old, killed in battle or killed by old age or something, and relax, and then you have a choice of where you want to be reborn. And that's what I thought was fascinating. You have the choice. You can be reborn as a boy or a girl or whatever you want. In a rich person, a poor person, whatever, famous person. You have that free choice. And they say the stupid people always want to be reborn as a rich and famous person. And he said the really smart ones get reborn as just in the middle somewhere. Not rich, not poor. Not that skilled and not that unskilled. He said the middle path, you're not really famous, you don't stand out, is a much more peaceful life for you. And that also reminds me of a little poem which when I first read I thought this is brilliant. And I wrote it in the book Opening the Door of Your Heart. It's in there somewhere. And it was on the birth of a child, I think by Sung Po. On the birth of my son, most people, when they give birth to a child, want it to be intelligent and smart. I, said the author, through intelligence, having wrecked my whole life, only hope the boy turns out to be stupid. Then he will live a tranquil life, and later on he will find success as a cabinet minister. Oh. And that was about 700, 800 years ago in China. And I thought, wow, that's really great. So if you do have a child, please hope it's stupid. And then it might become a prime minister. Oh, I get in trouble. Okay, anyway. There are certain truths which actually transcend religions. You know, that's why sometimes when you say these things that people can, no matter what religion, this really makes a lot of sense. Dear Ajahn B, you have given so many talks, traveled to so many places, helped so many people, also the head monk of the monastery, you work so hard, Do you ever feel burnout from all these responsibilities? I can't. The reason is because this is not burning season. We've got a fire ban now. I can't get burnout. No, but honestly, that just even this afternoon after all the questions, I was a bit exhausted. But I know how to recover. There's something which I've learned as being a Buddhist monk, a meditator, how to recover. And it surprises me, but I'm glad I know how to do it. You just go into your room, lock the door, and you meditate. And first of all, you're really tired. You don't fight it. That's a big trick. You just, you know, it's cause and effect. I've been working too hard. And I'm an old man now. So after a while, you may just got no energy. And then you just don't do anything. You just wait with kindness. And the tiredness, the exhaustion is right in front of me. It's the most important thing in the whole world. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I do is try and get rid of it. That is one of the mistakes people make. They don't like what's right in front of them right now. And that burns up so much energy trying to solve it. So I care for it instead. It's right in front of me and it always works. After 5, 10, 15 minutes you start to feel just human being again. And after half an hour, this is really good. And after an hour, oh yeah. And that's actually how you deal with this. And you get clarity. What is your secret sauce? That's how I learned meditation. Mm-hmm. Really is good. Tell us about the cow who came to live with in Dhammaloka. The cow? He's still there. No, it's a cow who came to live here. Yeah, the cow came to live. Oh, yeah. We found this cow here, and he was a bit wild. And because it was wild, you can't get close to cows. And so we left him alone for a while. And I think it was Christina who started looking after it?
Maybe Posada
did, but I think Christina as well.
Yeah.
But anyway, just leaving some good grass. We bought some grass or hay for it. And just left it there just to get its confidence so we're not going to harm it. And then it took about a year, didn't it? Before it became okay with us. And once it became okay with us, wasn't scared of us, we could actually see it had escaped from Karnak Prison Farm. And so its marker said, so we rang up, we can't steal things. And so we rang them up and said, okay, whatever you want to do with it. If you want this, didn't they say, if you want, we can come and shoot it? Yeah. I said, no way.
Back and put it in the abattoir.
Oh, yeah.
We had a Sangha meeting about.
Oh, yeah. So we didn't do that. So what we did instead, we rang around as places in Perth, really kind people who got a bit of land, and they really look after that animal. Said, we can't do that because, you know, you can't just have a cow in the property. You know, you have to know how to look after it and care for it and know if it's getting too hot or whatever. So we did actually take it. Where was that place?
Animal Sanctuary.
And so and what I was amazed at, it didn't try and run away when we got the truck there. It was actually quite happy to do that. It trusted us, I think. And we took it down there and they looked after it. Not by killing it, but just a place can live. It's like an old cow's home. Like sometimes you take your old mother or something. Be careful. But then, like animals, you can start to respect them. There was this cat who came over to Bodhinyana Monastery about 3 or 4 years ago. Remember that little cat which came here? It's a beautiful cat. It's really sort of cuddly and very friendly. And so, we didn't know what to do with it, so we stayed here for a little while. Spent the whole rains here. And we don't try and do much during the rains retreat, so it just stayed here. And it was very easy to look after, very nice cat, very cuddly, and never sort of run away. I didn't ever see it killing anything. But then after the rains retreat, what should we do about it? So we said, well, we should actually, maybe we can adopt it. Because all the monks, after 3 months, we're really softies. You fell in love with it, that's a nice little cat around, as long as it doesn't kill anything. But anyway, so what that cat did, we took it to the vet because it has to be legally registered and de-sexed. So we took it there and the vet said it's already been done. They had a record of it. We thought it was a female, I think, at first, but it was actually named George. Shows how much monks know. But anyway. And we rang up the owner. And the owner in South Perth, he said, I was wondering where George went. Did they come and collect it or we take it to them?
No, we gave it to Monica.
Oh, Monica, you did it, yeah. And you took it to the owner? You did.
I gave it to her.
Yeah, it's very nice, thank you. He was here. But I also wonder why he came here. Why did he come to Bodhinyana Monastery? And then, why do you, many of you, come to Bodhinyana Monastery for the rains retreat? He just wanted to retreat. So he had his 3 months retreat, but he couldn't stay any longer. Why are we so triggered by the flaws in others? A lot of times we see your flaws in yourself, for goodness sake. And when you see the mistakes in yourself, and you know how to deal with those things, in other words, you accept them, that's part of who you are. I remember asking somebody once, I said, would you really like Ajahn Brahm to stop telling stupid jokes, and to actually lose some weight, and to learn how to keep your robe on properly all the time? And the person I asked was very wise, said, no. We like you who you are. Mm-hmm. You've got flaws, faults. That makes you easy to relate to. Do you want to be perfect? If you were perfect, you'd be a pain in the bum for everybody else. You're not human. So sometimes your flaws, after a while, we don't see them as imperfections. We see them like the two bad bricks in the wall. This is your they make you more valuable. They're your
features.
That's right, features, yeah.
You charge more.
Charge more, yeah. You ever notice, it doesn't matter if a person is perfectly formed, or they're just not perfect in the way they speak. It's just whether they're kind, whether you can relate to them, and they've had experience like you've had, and so thereby that you can actually understand and feel safe. They understand what you're going through. And that was one of the reasons why we started Bhikkhuni monasteries. Because I understood when people said, sometimes the things you can talk about with bhikkhunis which monks don't understand. The things which you talk with bhikkhunis which they don't understand. Yes, okay. But anyway, it's nice to be able to have that choice there. And sometimes it's people you relate to and people you feel that, this is someone I really can trust. And someone who I can relate to. And having bhikkhunis, as well as bhikkhus, monks and nuns, is really important. I think, anyway. And anyway, okay, I haven't said this yet, this one, about why is it, though, that bhikkhunis always, they don't get as much respect as the monks do in the Buddhist world. You've got to be honest about that. And one of the reasons is our chanting. Our chanting, we do it twice a day. This is what should be done. Let none deceive another. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. So, tomorrow when you chant that, listen to it. And it's been true that when I pointed that out once, we actually changed the chanting. Whatever living beings they may be. Was it omitting monks? Let monks deceive another. Or disguise any being in any state. A little bit of fun. But anyway, why you prefer the term right renunciation to the traditional right effort? Does Ajahn Sujata also use this word? Doing many thanks. Now, a lot of times that many monks, if you're senior enough, you've been doing this a long time, to change them, after a while, the right rendering will actually become very popular. Like stillness is an obvious rendering for samadhi, for meditation, to jhanas. But even Ajahn Sujata, he apparently calls it immersion. Immersion? Mm-hmm. Right, immersion. What are you doing, having a sauna or something, or like a spa? But anyway, so that's why, you know, we try out new translations or new renderings and find out the one which works the best. Renunciation, that actually fits as well as the Eightfold Path, for those of you who know this Buddhism, as well as the Eightfold Path, we have what's called the gradual training. It's similar, and it's actually a parallel way of explaining the path. And instead of right effort, they have the renunciation, the sense restraint. And when I saw that, I said, I've got to find some way of just making sure that people realize these two different ways of saying the same thing. So that's why restraining is really great. Anyway, I'm going a bit faster now because we're going over time. How did you overcome the peer pressure of drinking alcohol when you became a Buddhist? Could you still have fun while you were in the presence of your friends? That was an amazing thing. Yes, I did. In fact, I had more fun. It was really weird that I thought if you didn't drink alcohol, then you know you can enjoy the party. But you can enjoy it even more, and you're much more in control, more alert. And so that you didn't need the alcohol to try and get rid of your worry about how other people thought of you. And you're much more alert afterwards. You enjoyed yourself more. And afterwards, you know, when after the end of the student time, when we all went our different ways, I asked my friends, said, I never took alcohol, and, you know, I was a Buddhist. What did you think about that all those years? And give me honest feedback. And they said, we were very happy and impressed because you never told us not to drink alcohol. You never tried to convert us to being Buddhists. You know, this was your thing, and we respected that, and you allowed us, you know, to sometimes have the party in my rooms, got big rooms, and thank you. And what I learned from that is, whatever you do, don't go and tell other people what to do. You know, your job is, you know, to inspire people. If they want to give up alcohol, great. If they don't, great. But I'm never going to force you to do anything. And my friend said that was really important for them, to see that I wasn't evangelist. And I wasn't saying, I'm not going to go to your party if you drink alcohol in my room. He didn't say it. That's their choice. And you were open to what they were doing. And so actually there was no peer pressure. They quite, you know, were very happy that I was there. Dear Ajahn Brahm, is it correct to hold a view that insight into many of the things covered in the sutta classes is only really possible after jhanas have been achieved? The deep insights, yes, because I've told that story of the tadpole and the frog so many times. Imagine just reading the sutras about the nature of water. It's wet. You know, you can wash with it, it's cooling or whatever, it's H2O or whatever. But that doesn't tell you what water really is. So the sutras are important because they give you what we call the map. But you do need a flashlight to walk through the forest, the jungle, and to be able to use that map to find the treasure, the enlightenment. So you need both, the flashlight and the map. And so the best map is the sutras, and the flashlight is the jhanas. You need both. How easy is it to attain to jhanas outside of retreat monastic settings? It does happen. Easy, hard? I really don't know, but because it's really important if you want to become enlightened, why not? So just teach it and whatever happens. After attending previous retreats and entering back into my normal lifestyle, work life, I start to feel and think like this way of living on retreat isn't realistic, and I begin to slip back into old unhelpful behaviours. Can you please suggest how to manage the transition back into a busy life while trying to live peacefully? Remember to learn as much as you can while you're here. And there's so many little techniques, just like this, investing in peace. In other words, spending 5 or 10 minutes, 15 minutes when you're at work, meditating at lunchtime. What was that story of the, many years ago, this story, this lawyer working in New York, and he's a criminal lawyer. And some of his clients, you know, if he got it wrong, it'd be the death penalty. So that was really stressful. And so he realized that, you know, he had to be on the top of his game. He had a person's life in his hands. And so anyway, that with his secretary, they cleared out this cupboard in his office. Had lots of papers in, not very big. But when he cleared the papers out of this office, he would get his secretary to lock him in there for half an hour every lunch hour. And his secretary would do this because, again, he was really, really a nasty fellow in the afternoon if he hadn't been locked in his cupboard for his meditation. And when people would call, I'm sorry, people sometimes say they're in a meeting. He said, no, it's in his cupboard. I've locked him in. And because he did that, you know, he could relax and rest. And that way he became a really good lawyer. And he wasn't so stressed out, so he could really see things clearly. I often say that, always remember, when you're in school, you have playtime in the morning, playtime in the afternoon, a rest at lunchtime, because a child can't learn, can't perform, if it's, you know, 8 hours solid work. But you do that, don't you? After work on whatever you're doing, hour after hour after hour after hour. And then when I realize how important having breaks are, time to re-energize your brain, then I realize that how my ancestors, the Brits, lost their empire. Because when they were very, very successful running so many countries, they would always have tea time in the morning. Mm-hmm. They'd have a lunch hour, they'd have tea time in the afternoon. Those tea breaks in the morning and afternoon were so important to being successful. And when they stopped those tea breaks to smokos and then no tea breaks at all, that's when they lost their empire. They didn't have a break to relax and rest. Okay, that's a bit of an exaggeration, you might not agree with me, but the empires are good anyway. But nevertheless, that idea of having a break, rest, not doing anything during your working day really helps. You can relax, bring up some good energy, and then find solutions to problems. There are, it's 24 minutes past 8. How are you going? Ha ha. Okay, So just go, this is the last night, so just go to another 5 minutes and then we'll finish off. So see which is the lucky ones, we'll get their question answered. Here we go. Please remind people not to talk. In the dining room, walkways, etc. Thank you. Okay, I'll do another one. How about some real ghost stories on the last night of the retreat? I did that with the coughing joke. Sorry? I've got a confession. Ooh. Do you want to hear it?
Yes.
Why? It's other people's stuff. Last night, under cover of darkness, I touched a Buddha inside a pagoda. Sincerely yours with a big heart. not a self. Who did that? Yeah. Okay. I feel I have found an inner space from where I can watch thoughts, body discomforts and feelings and emotions. The inner space feels compassionate, stable and always there. Could you please comment on this? Very good. It feels good. Then continue. I am so grateful to be here. What do you mean? But you are here. You're always here. Sometimes people think, I'm going tomorrow. I'm not going anywhere. Wherever I go, I'm always here. It's just you're not here tomorrow. Do you notice that? You're always here. Like somebody asked me, so this is some time ago, some of the nuns, are you going to be around tomorrow? I said, look, I'm around every day. But it is nice to be in the present moment, yes. I'm so grateful to be here. I just did this all for finish. I'm clucky. Yeah, please excuse me. I love this moment very much. Thanks, you, Ajahn, and to everyone. You guys are wonderful. Much better. Only the guys. No, all guys mean in Australia, all people. Dear Ajahn, quite a number of times I was at places where I have never been before. Were you allowed in there? However, somehow I have a feeling that I've been there before, but not physically. If it is true and if future is uncertain, then how could this happen? Oh, that sometimes you have deja vus. And if it's only a little bit in the future, then it can be true. Dear Ajahn, how do you end a meditation? You don't. You think you do, but the meditation keeps going on. I've ever noticed that I think now it's time to finish this session, but then I let go of that thought like I do with all other thoughts and just continue meditating. He says, okay, this is brilliant. Or should I stop when I think I should stop? No. Just let the body and mind decide. Comment. 60 billion stars review. Best retreat ever. We haven't finished yet. The best is yet to come. Best retreat ever. The sutta classes were excellent. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, the nuns, Leha and Christina, and all the five people who brought us food. That's something which is really wonderful, isn't it? Just all the food which you got here was brought to you. You didn't pay for it. If you paid for it, that would be just offensive to the people who bought it. I just want to make sure you have a good meditation. And sometimes that is. It's humbling. But people, they've been on these retreats, they know what it's like, they want to give you the very best. And they come all the way from Perth, put these things in the car, sometimes they get up so early in the morning, and they bring and they wash up for you as well. That is some of the nicest parts of the retreat. It's all done with no money involved. How can I maintain mindfulness when I return to a world with distractions like Facebook, Netflix, coronavirus, road rage, irrational people, attractive people, identity politics, China's ambitions, flat taxes, and Kentucky Fried Chicken? Okay. How can I maintain mindfulness? When you bite into that Kentucky Fried Chicken, do it mindfully as you put it into your mouth. You know, sometimes I was on this for another temple. I was in Kuala Lumpur. They were raising some funds for something. And so the MC was a very smart MC. He said, now we're going to do some mindfulness. Because it's not just about raising money and stuff. Do some mindfulness exercise. So I want you to lift your right hand. So you had all the people lift their right hand. And now put it on your chest. And they put it on their chest. Now slip it into your inside pocket. And they slipped it in. And now mindfully take out that leather thing you have, which you call your wallet. And this is a very powerful mindfulness exercise. Now get out that little plastic thing inside your wallet, called your credit card. And the people were just cracking themselves laughing, it didn't work. But anyway. Okay, what's when you go to world with distractions with Facebook? Limit those distractions. You don't have to do all of that. So that's one of the nice things about being here. Yay! You can't get a good signal in here. That's why I see many people having a walk. It's not for exercise, you know that. Okay, we've got the last question here. That's amazing. Just oh God, what's this one over here? No, this is the bhikkhunis one, so I'm free of blame for that one. It's the bhikkhunis. Dear Ajahn Brahm, my meditation is stuck in a state where you explain the spooky part, where the body back and head straight by itself. You know, that's not really spooky. After a while, you trust the body. It gives you confidence. You can disappear and the body will look after itself. After relax the max in meditation. Actually, it's really good sensation because I feel it every time I meditate. Brilliant. Problem is, after the energy push back the head up straight, after a while, the body back to no energy state, which head down and back bent. So the cycle keeps repeating itself until I'm out of meditation. Please guide how to overcome it. Very easy to get out of that if the body keeps moving like that. You can ask a leha to get the seat belt when you sit down. So it keeps you nice, and if the body keeps going down like that, you can have a crash helmet, just in case it goes down too far, with a crash helmet on and a seatbelt, you'll be so stable. Very easy. Okay, finish. Sadhu! 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 I apologize. Those are some of your questions. I hope you forgive me. I'm not trying to make fun of anybody, but just have to do it very quickly, and having a bit of humor does actually make the questions go much faster. Okay, so.
There's a question.
No, this is for bhikkhunis. Okay, come on.
Ajahn, can you read the question?
To any of the bhikkhunis, can you briefly explain why the bhikkhuni sangha slowly disappeared after the Buddha passed away? What happened to them during this period? And what is it like now, especially after the Ajahn Brahm movement? Yes, I'm going to go back to my hut now, so I'm moving. So, can you, to any one of the bhikkhunis?
Ajahn, I think they've left the question for you.
Can you read that? It's on me. Bhikkhus, bhikkhus. Why did bhikkhuni sangha slowly disappeared after Buddha passed away? Now, one of the reasons was that one of the rules was that a bhikkhuni should only ordain one disciple every 2 years. But we didn't do that because it's only, we need to get the bhikkhuni sangha started. That may be one reason. The other reason that the bhikkhu sangha itself got less and less and less for a while. Sometimes it disappeared in some places. For example, it disappeared in Sri Lanka. Remember? And I think the Dutch were there, and they got monks over from Thailand. And actually the monks in Thailand got reinstated by the monks over in Sri Lanka or Burma. And so we always, this is our custom, because we have many different countries. When it runs out in one place, We used to get monks to come from another place to get it started again. The same with bhikkhunis. So it's just, we keep sort of cross-fertilizing. And the bhikkhuni sangha didn't disappear. That's a myth. Because from Sri Lanka, it's recorded in the history that they sent some bhikkhunis to China to get the bhikkhuni sangha started over there. And of course they, you know, wear different robes, they chant differently in China than they do to Sri Lanka, but nevertheless the rules are compatible, especially the rules for the ordination. That's one of the things which I had to really research. Those bhikkhunis in China, are they compatible with the bhikkhunis in the time of the Buddha? And the answer was a very clear yes. So they're bhikkhunis. Whether they're Mahayana, Vajrayana or Theravada is not important. They're bhikkhunis. Once you have bhikkhunis, then they can ordain other bhikkhunis. So when you saw those things, this bhikkhuni sangha would never run out. It just carried on in China, different language, different coloured robes, but there were still bhikkhunis. There always have been. So that lineage has not been broken. Just because it was Mahayana, we thought, there's no Theravada bhikkhunis, therefore we can't ordain Theravada bhikkhunis. You can! Your bhikkhunis first, and then your Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana afterwards. Your bhikkhu first, and then your forest tradition, Sri Lankan tradition, this tradition, that tradition, but the bhikkhu first of all. And that's really nice to know. Sometimes people like to make different sects, and you can't come into our sect, no. But of course you can. That's just that elitism sometimes is not part of the Buddhist tradition. And if they do have different sects within the Buddhist tradition, it's mostly for preserving power and prestige. It's got no real justification in the teachings of the Buddha. Even the Buddha actually said that anybody who unites sort of two different sects of Buddhism in Thailand or in Sri Lanka or Burma, anywhere, if you manage to get them to come together, that's incredibly good karma. And it's easy to do. And one of the sayings is there are two reasons for creating different sects, Nana Sangwasa. Is either there's an act of the Sangha, which you can only do it on one, two or three monks or nuns at a time, or you just decide. You choose. You don't need any great Sangha Kama, a great meeting of all the monks. If I wanted to, say, be a Korean monk, Jogchay order, they're compatible with us. The Vinaya is very similar. And I wouldn't need to sort of disrobe and start all over again. I just go over to South Korea and just change my robes. I'm still capable of the seniority of 47 years as a monk. And to me, that's beautiful. You know, we've got this tradition all over the world, and it's nothing which really divides us, except from ignorance and power and privilege. Yeah, identity view, yeah. But this is how the Buddha taught it, and it's brilliant. And so that means you can, personally it feels great, you can go anywhere in the world. There's a Buddhist monastery there. Can I come in and stay the night? You have to be allowed to stay. Because every monastery in our world does not belong to the Thai tradition. It doesn't really belong to the BSWA. The monastery belongs to the Sangha of the Four Quarters, present and yet to come. It means all monks, all nuns, now and in the future. Four Quarters means east, west, north and south. Everywhere. I kind of like that idea. It's for all monks and nuns. Yay. So that's why I never really disappeared. It was hidden, but you felt, hey, it's there. Once you get rid of the politics, it's so easy to restate it and get it going again. Everywhere. Okay. I'll take the message.
A joke,
for you. A joke, okay. A joke, the last joke of the night.
I was thinking of the seven elephants. What kind of cup of coffee would I be if one of his seven elephants found me? A flat white, of course.
Yay! Sadhu! 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 Okay, very good. Okay.